Thank you for being with us this evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday night, May 19th, 2020, on a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. Ahead tonight, navigating state systems for financial assistance during the pandemic. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich and Zuzanna Sitek have reports about the Ready for Business Grant Program and the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. That's just ahead. Tomorrow morning on 1A on KUAF, Daniel misses his friend Bob. And in every state, the pain has been made worse for all those who missed out on a moment to say goodbye. Daniel says the hardest part is that his friend is gone forever. Listeners continue to honor friends and loved ones lost too soon. Grieving at a distance is part of the conversation tomorrow morning on 1A from 9 to 11 on 91.3 KUAF. The Department of Health counts 1,082 active cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas today, with 110 new cases, most of them categorized as community cases, reported during the most recent 24-hour measuring period. There have now been 102 virus-related deaths in Arkansas. That's an increase of 2 since yesterday. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas Secretary of Health, says his department has been watching to see if a high number of new cases can be connected to a specific source of infection.
We've had a total of all of our 1,082 active cases. Only 3 of them had reported being to a restaurant within that incubation period. Only 6 had reported being to a barber shop, 10 to a church, 3 to a daycare, and 4 to a gym. Each of those are 1% or less. So these activities don't appear to be driving our community cases at this point.
Dr. Smith says 94 cases in the past 24 hours have been moved into the recovered category, and he says the state continues to increase testing.
Yesterday was an all-time high for us in terms of testing. There were 3,014 tests done with a 1.5% positivity.
Governor Asa Hutchinson says the state continues to work toward a goal of 60,000 tests in May, and as of mid-afternoon today, the state's conducted nearly 40,000 tests. He says the state is adopting a plan to eventually test the entirety of the nursing home community in Arkansas.
Beginning June 1, our goal is to test every nursing home resident and staff person in a nursing home facility in Arkansas. This will result in approximately 40,000 to 50,000 new tests simply by testing staff and nursing home residents next month in June in those facilities. If you add to that, of course, our routine testing, you're going to see a very large number of tests next month here in Arkansas. This additional testing will better protect our nursing home residents, it will protect our staff, and it'll give confidence to our staff, our residents, that we're doing everything we can to make sure that there is no spread and contagion in these facilities.
And the governor says the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance website continues to be down, pending further examinations of a security breach. Tomorrow, Governor Hutchinson will be in the White House to meet with President Trump and Vice President Pence to discuss Arkansas's approach to the virus during the pandemic. The governor says he'll be taking the proper precautions for the visit to the West Wing.
I will be wearing a mask. I understand that is required in the West Wing, but I would be wearing a mask anyway. Secondly, they will be testing me before I go in to the West Wing, so that will actually be my first COVID-19 test. And beyond that, I expect to have a normal meeting with the president and return to Arkansas.
The president's press briefings are archived at his YouTube channel, and you can follow more COVID-19 news for the state and our region at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com. A combined statement from multiple area healthcare entities is assuring residents it's safe to go to hospitals and clinics in the area. The joint statement from Arkansas Children's Northwest, Mercy, Northwest Health, UAMS Health, Washington Regional, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and Community Clinic lists ways area hospitals and clinics are making the risk of exposure to the coronavirus minimal. According to the statement, the most patients with COVID-19 in hospitals in Northwest Arkansas occurred in early April. And in the last several weeks, the combined number of patients with COVID-19 in area hospitals has been in the single digits. The hospitals also report they have delivered nearly 1,000 newborns since March. This is Ozarks at Large. Tens of thousands of applicants to Arkansas's Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program have been waiting weeks for financial aid, aid that would be issued to the self-employed, freelancers, and gig economy workers under the Federal CARES Act. Last week, they were told the money could start flowing this week. That is, until the website turned up a security breach. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has more.
The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, part of the federal $2 trillion CARES Act, provides compensation to those who don't normally qualify for traditional unemployment insurance. Take 30-year-old Sky Pollard, an award-winning singer-songwriter who resides in Eureka Springs. He says his music career was starting to take off when the pandemic shut everything down.
It was a serious snowball effect, to tell you the truth. The last show that I got to play, so the last job I got to work was on March the 7th.
Pollard says he first applied for pandemic unemployment assistance May 1st, and it took several attempts. Now he's just waiting.
Because at this point in time, to be quite frank with you, anything at all would be better than nothing. At least then I could get a couple of my bills paid that I haven't been able to pay.
Ray Dilfield, who's 69, has operated the 1881 Crescent Cottage Inn in Eureka Springs for 20 years with his spouse.
This has caused us a big problem in trying to get the assistance from the government because they want to be able to verify our incomes individually. And we have no way of separating out our joint income through the inn. I mean, we have our 1099s from Social Security, but the rest of it is just one big nebulous pocket that we can't prorate to their satisfaction.
Dilfield, who just reopened the B&B after a fire, says no state workforce agents appears to have a program script process a joint filing application with a Schedule C business income.
We are stuck and cannot get a decent answer out of anybody of how we're supposed to proceed.
State Senator Greg Letting, District 4 Fayetteville, has been fielding numerous complaints from Northwest Arkansas constituents on his Facebook feed.
I'm hearing from a lot of angry Arkansans who are desperate for support because a lot of them have been out of work since mid to late March. And they were promised support by the end of April originally. And then it was the beginning of May. And so there are a lot of frustrated people out there.
According to an email provided by Division of Workforce Services spokesperson Zoe Calkins, 29,000 Arkansans have applied for pandemic unemployment assistance, providing self-employment earnings verification documents. Last week, nearly 6,000 claimants were notified they had to reload online uploaded documents due to a web malfunction. Qualified claimants, Calkins says, will receive benefits based on earnings for up to 10 months, a minimum of $132 per week, up to a maximum of $451. In addition, Calkins says, claimants that receive a weekly PUA benefit will also receive $600 weekly from the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation Fund for up to 13 weeks. Late last week, at the governor's daily coronavirus press briefing, Secretary of Commerce Mike Preston assured claimants checks would be issued starting this week.
I know we're working very closely right now on the certification and the payment process of this. Obviously, a lot of testing will go into that as we're dealing with banking account information and routing information, and we want to make sure that site and system is secure as possible.
But late Friday, the Arkansas Times reported that an applicant identified only as a computer programmer had discovered a vulnerability. He told the Times that before he contacted the Journal, he called the Division of Workforce Services with no result, then alerted Arkansas State Police Criminal Investigation Division. On Saturday, Governor Asa Hutchinson, at a daily coronavirus press briefing, addressed the breach.
Last night, I learned of a potential security incident in which an applicant seems to have illegally accessed the system. When this was discovered, it was necessary to shut the system down. And the sequence of events that we have to go through in our protocols is that law enforcement is notified of the breach. We obviously notify our cyber insurance carrier. Forensics are currently being conducted by an outside IT expert that we want to make sure that the system is in good shape before it goes back online.
The fate of the whistleblower remains unknown. The governor says the PUA program system was cooperatively built by the state departments of commerce and finance with help from an independent IT contractor. Yesterday, Monday morning, the Democratic Party of Arkansas held a press conference demanding a bipartisan investigation. This is Chair Michael John Gray.
Who administered this contract? Who oversaw this contract? What are the ramifications to those who chose this vendor? What are the ramifications to the vendor that has had constant delays and then obviously a huge failure in the ability for people's personal information to be able to be accessed?
At his daily coronavirus press briefing Monday afternoon, Governor Hutchinson brushed off Gray's call to action as shameful, characterizing it as a partisan attack.
This matter is being investigated by the FBI, and my information is that the data was exploited. But when you say exploited, I believe that is a technical term of art that includes visual seeing of somebody else's data. And so that is a concern to us, and that is what constitutes a breach.
The governor says it appears no applicant data has been stolen and a third-party vendor will certify when the site is secure for opening. At that point, final applications will be taken and the first round of payments will finally be issued. Pandemic unemployment assistance applicant John Joseph Ray, a self-employed massage therapist and continuing education instructor, says he had to stop treating clients in mid-March.
And then for my continuing education business, I had to stop that around the same time because of the directive about gatherings indoors.
Speaking Saturday late afternoon on the porch of his forested home in Fayetteville, Ray, a former computer programmer and software developer, says the PUA portal has lots of bugs. He's angered by what the PUA applicant turned whistleblower found.
He realized that if he just took some part of the address of the site off, he could actually get into the back end of the site, the part of the website where the programmers do all the programming. And I understand that very well because I used to be a programmer and I was a software development manager for many years in Dallas, and I managed two websites for my businesses. And not only that, but this programmer was able to find that he could access the database on the site where all this information was stored, the social security numbers, the banking routing numbers, et cetera, for all these people very, very easily. I mean, you wouldn't even need to be a programmer to have been able to access this. And so I was shocked and also very angry because these are the kinds of things that in the software development world should never happen.
For now, any applicant who clicks on the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance website will see a white screen with large type that says service temporarily unavailable. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And while thousands of self-employed Arkansans wait for money from the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, thousands of business owners are also waiting for funding from the Arkansas Ready for Business Grant Program. That program, which is being financed using federal funds, ran into its own set of issues when it was rolled out nearly 3 weeks ago. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek reports.
On April 29th, as Governor Asa Hutchinson began outlining plans for businesses to start reopening this month, he and Arkansas Commerce Secretary Mike Preston also announced the launch of a new grant program called Arkansas Ready for Business.
It's a $15 million grant program to assist companies through this restart phase.
The grants were intended for expenses related to personal protective equipment, hand sanitizer stations, cleaning supplies, and any other one-time purchases businesses would have to make to reopen safely. That day, Preston said consumer confidence would be an important part of restarting sectors of the economy that had to shut down all or some of their operations at the start of the outbreak.
We wanted to make sure that we can help businesses mitigate that risk and that loss. So that's why we wanted to make it so important to get these funds out to those who are in need. So if you think of these restaurants who maybe have been closed for a month or longer, they're going to need to go through a deep cleaning process. They're going to need to have thermometers to be able to scan their employees, to go through all the things to make sure they're meeting the health guidelines that have been set forth.
But the Arkansas Ready for Business program ran into a problem from the start. It was launched later that day at 5 p.m. During a briefing on April 30th, Hutchinson said there was a communication error and the website was rolled out before the Legislative Council approved funding for the program.
The gun was jumped on that and the website went live. And it was a typical rollout because as you present a new grant program, you want to make sure that as many stakeholders as are possible are aware of that. And so those steps were taken. So it was not an issue of favoritism. It was a matter of this is how you get information out about a new small business grant program.
Before the site was taken down, it had attracted more than 2,300 applications, totaling $36 million in under an hour. This had some wondering if industry associations got advance notice about the grant program. That included Representative Deanne Vaught, a Republican who represents District 4. She expressed her concerns on social media, stating more money would have to be found to give every business owner a fair shake, which did eventually happen. The grant program website reopened on May 5th, and legislators approved increasing funding from $15 million to nearly $148 million. But the Legislative Council took Commerce Secretary Mike Preston to task this past Friday. Senator Terry Rice, a Republican from Waldron, questioned the fairness of the process.
We're trying to rebuild through transparency and through being forthright with the citizens to try to rebuild some trust. In this rollout of this program, I'm not going to put it on anybody, but I can tell you, it's plain to see. People knew ahead of time.
While Rice said he didn't believe Preston was being malicious in his intent, he took issue with what he sees as a casual attitude toward the legislature. Preston had this response.
Hey, Representative, with all due respect, I certainly appreciate the legislature. I appreciate everyone in this body and know that they're duly elected by the citizens of Arkansas. As I stated last week, And if you went back and saw my comments, I mentioned at the press conference that this would be going live. That was it. That was the first time that we talked about that publicly to anyone.
Representative Robin Lundstrom, a Republican from Elm Springs, also expressed confusion about how the first applicant submitted a 16-page application at 5:04 p.m. on April 29th.
There is no way in 4 minutes that somebody could do that unless they were magical. So I just have a hard time believing that that site was not live before 5 o'clock. I don't care what anybody has to say, but there's no way in 4 minutes you could do that.
Jim Hudson, the general counsel for the Commerce Department, who was also present at the meeting, said he clearly cannot overcome her skepticism, but he is someone who takes his honor and trustworthiness very seriously.
I sit here today and I tell you that what we provided you is absolutely true. I came into public service with a good name. I shall leave one with a good name.
But Lundstrom remained unconvinced. First, you'll hear from her, then you'll hear a response from Secretary Mike Preston.
I'm not questioning your honesty. I'm questioning that this website may have been turned on a little bit early, and with a wink and a nod, some people got in line ahead of time. And I'd like to know what's going on. I'm concerned.
Representative, when you say a wink and a nod, that does...
It has some very negative implications.
Our integrity, and that is not the case.
Max Brantley at the Arkansas Times takes issue with Preston's assertion. In an article published this weekend based on information he obtained through a Freedom of Information request, he writes that Preston's staff, the governor's staff, and a lobbyist for the Arkansas Department of Commerce began circulating word of the grant program at least 4 hours before the governor's April 29th briefing. About 15 minutes after the briefing began, the details of the program were distributed to business lobbyists and other insiders. Brantley also writes that business insiders from local chambers of commerce were further briefed at 3 p.m. by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission. Both Governor Asa Hutchinson and Secretary Preston were asked about that at Saturday's coronavirus response briefing.
I think that has just been beaten to death by a number of different hearings in the legislature. But Mike, do you have a word on that?
We've turned over all emails on that, and I think if you look at the emails and everything that we've said, that there was information about an economic development partner call that happened. That information went out. That was addressed that day in the press conference. So all those folks were made aware, and that was made public at that time. There was no advance notice given, and I know if you read through all the emails and the Freedom of Information Act and everything that was provided by the Economic Development Commission, that supports that.
During Monday morning's news conference, aside from demanding a bipartisan investigation into the pandemic unemployment assistance program, the Democratic Party of Arkansas also demanded an investigation into the initial rollout of the Arkansas Ready for Business program. Here's Democratic Party of Arkansas Chairman Michael John Gray.
Just because you make a mistake and fix it, it doesn't mean we quit talking about it. We all would love if every time we made a mistake, we fixed it, people would just let it go. But the point is, a mistake was made, the trust was broken, people got insider knowledge, and we should know why and who, and those who did it should be held accountable.
Gray says everything in the current time has been politicized, but he hopes Republican legislators in Arkansas would throw their support behind both investigations.
I can tell you that there is bipartisan frustration with the answers they're getting from the bureaucrats and from governor staff and from leadership. There's definitely bipartisan frustration there.
While Gray says it would be irresponsible to place blame solely on Commerce Secretary Mike Preston, he adds that he was encouraged by the questions legislators posed for him this past Friday.
So I would hope that we move past whose fault it is and we move into how do we keep this from happening again? Why was the trust of Arkansans breached, and what do the solutions look like going forward?
As you heard in Jacqueline Froelich's report, the governor characterized Gray's call to action as a disappointing partisan attack. Ozarks at Large also reached out to the Republican Party of Arkansas for comment, but did not yet get a response. If and when we do, we will provide that information during a future episode of this show. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
In that Monday morning news conference, the Democratic Party of Arkansas chair also said the organization would like to see some sort of financial benefit for people who were deemed essential and continued working through the pandemic. Michael John Gray says in some instances, those people were making less than those who filed for unemployment and received an additional $600 on top of their regular unemployment check through a provision in the Federal CARES Act.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
And the University of Arkansas women's tennis team is being recognized for community service. The Razorbacks earned the 2020 Central Regional ITA Community Service Award for logging more than 214 hours of service during the just-completed academic year. The team made visits to Arkansas Children's Northwest, participated in Christmas programs with area children, and promoted exercise in area schools. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Tuesday. Special Olympics Arkansas is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. The organization had plans to host its summer games this week, but that changed with the arrival of coronavirus in the state. Although the games have been canceled, the nonprofit is still finding ways to celebrate athletes and deliver programs in new ways. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with the organization's CEO over Zoom to learn more, and Antoinette has this report.
In January of 2017, I visited the Jones Center in Springdale to watch the annual Special Olympics Arkansas Winter Games. It was here that I met CJ Nash, a goalie for the Magnolia Magic's floor hockey team. At the time, he told me he participated in several sports like bocce and volleyball, but floor hockey and basketball were his favorites because they involve a lot of running.
Growing up, I didn't get a chance to participate. I got to participate in basketball, but I didn't get a lot of playing time because I had a coach I didn't understand. But then it's heartfelt when you get teammates who are like you and they get to participate.
Since its founding in 1970, the nonprofit has grown to serve more than 15,000 athletes like CJ from around the state. Terry Weir calls herself a lifer when describing her relationship with Special Olympics. She volunteered in North Little Rock during high school and college. She became the director of outreach in 1989, and today she's the organization's CEO. Weir says she learned a lot about intellectual disabilities from her great uncle, who had Down syndrome.
My grandmother, she gave birth to him, and was told to leave him in the hospital. This was probably in the 30s or the 40s, and that they would take care of that. And she didn't. She brought him home. She raised him just like she did her other four children. And so I saw growing up that their lives are worthy just as ours are.
The mission of Special Olympics Arkansas is to provide year-round sports training and athletic competition in a variety of Olympic-type sports for athletes with intellectual disabilities. Unfortunately, several sporting events were canceled this spring because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And I can tell you right now that our athletes miss being on the playing field and miss being on the court and miss being on the track and miss being in the pool, just like every other athlete.
Special Olympics Arkansas has been able to pivot and has started offering some programs virtually. For example, the organization is hosting a virtual Polar Plunge fundraiser.
So it's okay, right, to be 50 years old and then realize that there's a pandemic and you have to grow, you have to change, you have to be different in different ways that you open up your program to people. And so we started offering virtual coaches clinics and general coaches clinics for all of our volunteers, our athletes. We're doing some different health initiatives, we're looking at a Unified Champion Schools conference that would be held virtually. We're trying with all of our might, and we have had great success. The amazing thing is that we've wanted for so long and haven't had the opportunity to take a breath, to like stop and go, hey, let's work on this for a little bit. And, you know, we did. We were made to stop for a little bit and figure out a different way of opening the eyes and telling our story to different people.
Another thing that's had to change is the organization's summer games. The original plan was to kick off the games with a week-long law enforcement torch run from all over the state before competition began at Harding University. This year's games have been canceled, but law enforcement agencies are still organizing a modified torch run that keeps social distancing in mind.
They are having cruisers carry the flame, so it's all social distancing. They're going to be carrying the flame of hope for inclusion and acceptance all the way from the Capitol steps at 9:30 in the morning on Thursday, May 21st, to Searcy, to the home, to Harding of our summer games.
Nearly 100 agencies and 1,500 officers work year-round to raise awareness and money for Special Olympics. In 2019, Weir says they raised $591,000 for her organization. While this year's torch run will be different than previous ones, she's grateful for the continued support.
I just couldn't believe that those law enforcement officers that love our athletes so much would take time away from their community and from their family and to serve our athletes and to love our athletes and to just pause and celebrate for our athletes in such a unique way as we celebrate our 50th anniversary this year.
Anyone can join in the event virtually by purchasing a 2020 Torch Run shirt and sharing pictures of them wearing it on social media. Special Olympics Arkansas has had to change the way they deliver their programs quickly, and Weir says she thinks they've done a good job adapting.
The reception from doing that has been phenomenal, and hearing different people call in and say, you know, thank you for doing this for us, or, you know, different social media posts about different trainings that we have going on. It's been an exciting time. As sad as it is, it's been an exciting time to see us grow in a new way.
More information is available at specialolympicsarkansas.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on my front porch on Mount Sequoia, we're recording this during social distancing times, is our militant grammarian, Catherine Schultz. Welcome back.
Hi, Kyle. Good to see you from so far away.
Yes, we are. Yes, point that out. We are more than 6 feet apart. Yes. What do you got for us this time?
I've done a few outside presentations as the militant grammarian. Not outside like this, but
right.
Outside of KUF.
Yes.
I use funny memes from the internet for enhancement of my presentation. After all, you aren't there to liven things up.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say.
One of the funniest memes shows a pie chart under the title, Today's Uses of the Semicolon.
Oh, yes.
A thin slice colored orange represents the use, quote, to separate sentences.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it is colored blue, and it's labeled to make winky faces on the internet.
Which is probably very true.
Yeah. But that's not what I want to talk about
today. Good. Nothing against a semicolon, but good.
I saw an article about another punctuation mark. Unfortunately, there's not one inclusive word for it because it has so many uses.
What is that?
I knew it as the pound mark.
Oh.
Until Twitter came along.
Right.
And now we know it as what?
The hashtag.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I knew most of these uses, but a couple of them were a surprise. Let's see what you know about it.
Oh.
I'll call it hashtag for convenience.
Okay.
What does the hashtag denote if it's used before a digit, as in hashtag 12?
Number mm-hmm. 7?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, number 12, number mm-hmm. 7,
yeah,
number
it would
8.
It would be 12 since I said 12.
Yes. Okay.
What if you put the hashtag what if you put the hashtag after the digits?
Pounds.
Yes.
It weighs 12 pounds.
Yeah. Kyle, I don't know if you ever got close enough to print journalism to copy edit.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, I did, but it was a long time ago for a short amount of time.
But the hashtag has a special use for marking up manuscripts. Do you know what it is?
No, I do not. Okay.
It's the printer's, when you're proofing something, it's a symbol for space. Put a space in here.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Okay, how about music? I can't read music, but can you, Kyle?
Oh, gosh, no. I wish I could, but no.
Well, what does the hashtag mean on a musical staff?
A half note.
Sharp.
Oh.
Sharp note.
Is half note a thing?
What if I wanted you to play a game with me? How could we use the hashtag?
It's a tic-tac-toe board.
It is a tic-tac-toe, although it's slanted, but it's tic-tac-toe.
I'd never thought of that.
You'd have to have a few before you played it on hashtag. I found in my research that there are lots of other uses in technology, business, and medicine, just to name a few.
Really?
One use has spawned many an internet posting about what it's called when it's used on telephones. Did you realize there's one on your telephone?
Yeah, the pound key is what I always called it.
That's what they call it. They call it the pound key.
Is it still on, like, cell phones?
Yes,
I mean, it was on landlines.
I had to check. Okay. It is. Uh-huh. Since the day of the Princess phone, telephone keyboards contain a hashtag at the bottom right-hand corner. When an automated voice wants you to use that key, it usually says press the pound key.
Yeah.
However, the key is actually called an octothorpe.
I did not know that.
I silenced Kyle with that.
I did not. Octothorpe. So if someone says push the octothorpe.
Yeah. Right. It would engender another whole conversation.
Yes.
One of the many unsubstantiated theories about how it came to be called that is a desire among some Bell Lab employees to annoy international users by inventing a name that is difficult to say in some languages.
Oh, my gosh. I hope that's not true.
So they put the TH in there to make it difficult.
Oh.
Outside of computing or telecoms, no one knows it's called an octothorpe.
No. No.
There is another use in journalism for hashtags used in threes.
Oh.
Do you know what that is?
It's at the end of a story, right? Yeah.
That's right.
Or, yes.
Yeah. Three hashtags at the end of the copy in reporting tells the copy editor or typesetter that he's done. I much prefer the dash 30 dash.
Yeah.
Which does the same thing.
You know, I would see the three octothorpes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they wouldn't be octothorpes since they're not on a phone. I've seen the three hashtags also to separate on wire copy. Like in the old days, AP, that story's over. This is a different story.
But it still says end of story. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's 30 for now.
Catherine Sheralds, our militant grammarian. And this is Ozarks at Large. Since the onset of the pandemic, thousands of Arkansans have spent a half hour or so most days watching the daily briefings from Governor Asa Hutchinson, designed to give us updates about the state's approach to the virus and the associated economic fallout. Almost every day, we've also heard from Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health. This weekend, Dr. Smith, from a very safe social distance, sat down with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics, to discuss where we've been during the outbreak and where we might be headed. Roby asked Dr. Smith about the congregate populations that have had some high spikes of infection, including prisons and nursing homes, and what can be done to make those populations safer.
Part of the answer is that it's really very, very difficult to protect your most vulnerable as long as you have lots of transmission in the community. I think a lot of people pointed to the example of Sweden, where they had a strategy where they would really not be concerned about transmission in the community, but try and protect the most vulnerable. Well, I don't think that strategy really works very well, and I'm not sure it's working very well for them, because it's impossible to protect the most vulnerable if you have a lot of COVID-19 activity outside of those settings.
Did luck play a little bit of part in us not getting hit as hard as some other places? I mean, we didn't have a Mardi Gras, we didn't have a spring break, we don't have that population density. Was some of it just blind luck?
I guess you could call it whatever you want. Divine providence is probably what I would prefer to say.
Okay. Senator Rand Paul testified on Tuesday that he suggested schools could open this fall because children are not becoming as infected with this as older people in the population have been. First of all, do you kind of share that sentiment, number one? And two, what are going to be the conditions for in-person education this fall?
Well, the latter part of your question, I think the governor has made it clear, and I think many other governors as well, that the intention is that we would have an in-class school year starting in the fall, and I really hope that that is possible. I think we will all work very hard to make that possible. Now, the first part of your question was, are kids immune to COVID-19? Not really. Fortunately, they are less likely to become severely ill, but as we have learned from the experience in New York and some other places, there are some complications from COVID-19 that can very adversely affect children. And so we want to protect our children, but also in a school setting, it's not just children, it's their teachers. And many of our school teachers have risk factors. And then it's their families when they come home, and it's grandparents, et cetera. So we are a highly integrated society, and I don't think it's possible to just say, let COVID-19 run loose in this sector and then hope that we can protect others.
I think a lot of people, and I see this in the press conferences, I have these same thoughts too. We want to pin you down on what is going to be the environment to allow some of these things to happen. And that's probably a little bit of I'll know it when I see it kind of attitude in terms of looking at the data and understanding. Is that a fair assessment, or is there something a little bit more structured in the decision making?
Right. The best response to many of these settings is highly contextual. By that, I mean, we got to see what the situation is, what the best choices are, and our knowledge, our understanding of this virus is emerging very quickly. Remember, this was not really even known until the very end of December. Really wasn't identified until the first part of this year, and it seems like an eternity, but it's only May.
It's too late to reopen schools this year, and that decision was made a few weeks ago. But if you're looking at the environment we have now as we're reopening businesses and other parts of Arkansas, if the circumstances were like they are right now this fall, would you have confidence in opening up the schools for in-person education?
I think things would have to be different before I would be comfortable opening schools. But I could see a variety of scenarios. We have seen a general downward trend, both in terms of new cases and hospitalizations. And over the course of the summer, we're able to sort of wrangle this epidemic in Arkansas down to the ground to where we have a very, very low case numbers. Then I think that going to school and being highly vigilant, if we had an outbreak, jumping on it quickly with our case investigations and contact tracing, I think that would be one option. Another option was to scale up our testing to such a point that we can basically be screening people often enough to know who's positive and who's negative. If there's no one who's infected, then it doesn't really matter what you do in terms of social distancing, you're going to be okay. But to have that testing capability to where you could know that for sure, that's not where we are now, but it could be where we are in the fall.
In this reopening of Arkansas for business, what was the pivotal juncture for you to feel like it was time to do that? There's a set of data points that you're looking at. There's some reality of we've got to get the economy moving again. What kind of tipped you past the point of it's okay for us to take a little bit of the foot off the gas pedal on the restrictions on this?
Well, for me, in terms of that decision, it was a very complicated decision. There's a lot of factors involved. I know it was a tough decision for the governor to make. When are we going to start moving forward? But as you pointed out, we can't stay in lockdown forever. You know, once we run out of financial resources, no one has a job, no one has any money, we can't protect anyone from anything, let alone COVID-19. On the other hand, we had gotten a lot of positive benefit over the things that we did. We really, really were able to bend the curve. None of the dire predictions from the predictive models really came true in terms of surge, you know, hospital capacity, ventilators, things like that. So we knew we were going to be okay from that standpoint. And so the question is, can you completely get rid of it with the things that we were doing? Not likely in a state like Arkansas, where we've got surrounding states that all have at least as high or higher case per population. When is it safe to start moving in that direction? Once we saw the number of cases coming down, president's opening up America again, gating criteria, meeting those were all things that were telling us we were heading in a direction where it was safe to start reopening and watching carefully.
What was the gating criteria? It wasn't the 14-day downward trajectory, because we've not had 14 days of moving downward with our caseloads. But what was the gating criteria?
Well, the gating criteria are threefold. The first one had to do with symptoms and COVID-like symptoms. That was a 14-day, more than 14-day downward trend. Also, there's a system called ILINET, Influenza-Like Illness Network, which we used during flu season, and we did see a downward trend on that one as well. So that was the first criteria. The second one was cases, and there was a 14-day downward trend in cases, which we eventually did meet, also a downward trend, 14-day downward trend in the percent positive tests, and we clearly met that one. It was an either or on that criteria. And then the third criteria had to do with hospital capacity. And we were never close to our maximum hospital capacity.
Well, was it always about making sure that we didn't overwhelm the hospital resources? That has been an argument that some people have made is, we weren't doing this to eliminate the coronavirus. It was going to be in our communities and in our system no matter what. The goal originally with the lockdown was to keep the hospital system from being overwhelmed. Was that what was driving policy at that time, or was there more than that?
Well, that has always been an important policy objective, both nationally and here in Arkansas as well. And it's important because in settings where they have overwhelmed the healthcare system, the number of deaths and people injured is not just those who have COVID-19, but those who had treatable conditions who couldn't get care because they couldn't get into a hospital, or they were afraid to go to the hospital because they were afraid of getting COVID-19. And that's still very much a real part of our policy objectives, is to get our healthcare system back up and running. There are still people I know who are reluctant to go to the doctor or go to the hospital because they're afraid of COVID-19. I mentioned yesterday that my in-laws were concerned about going to a needed clinic visit because of that, and we just had a conversation, and fortunately they went, and my father-in-law got the care that he needed. But I think a lot of people have those concerns. But it's not the only policy objective. Obviously, I'm equally concerned about saving people's lives, not overwhelming our healthcare system. So It's a both and. In public health, we oftentimes have to do more than one thing at one time.
Was there any political pressure to restart the economy, to reopen the economy? Was this you coming to the governor and saying it's time to do this, or was this the governor coming to you and saying, Nate, when is the time to do this?
This has been an ongoing conversation between me and the governor from the beginning, and I understand that public health isn't just about health care. It's about people's entire environment they live in. We sometimes call that the social determinants of health. Right. And I will guarantee you that there'll be more people who die this year in Arkansas from conditions that are more closely tied to their socioeconomic status than to COVID-19.
Obesity, diabetes, heart failure, things like that.
Exactly. We are very, very interrelated between our economy, education, and health. It's really not possible to achieve optimal health for all without a strong and healthy economy and a good educational system.
Let's move back to testing that we talked about earlier. We've laid out some goals for where we're going to try to get with testing. You've got the 60,000 mark that you guys have put out there. I think you've got 90,000 new test kits. That number may have changed. What's the best we're going to get in terms of testing in Arkansas? And we're not alone in this. Every state's struggling. But what's the highest percentage of what we're going to be able to test? And what would you prefer we be able to do if there was no limitation on those resources?
Well, I think we're going to be able to achieve a lot more in terms of testing. Quite honestly, now anyone who needs a complete blood cell count or a Chem 7, can go into the hospital or go into a clinic and they can get that test done. The testing for COVID-19 is no more complicated. And so we will get there, I am confident. In fact, we will probably, just the way markets work, we'll probably overshoot where there'll be eventually more supply than demand.
Dr. Nate Smith is Arkansas's Secretary of Health. This weekend, he spoke with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. You can find out more at talkbusiness.net.
With millions of cars off the roads, you'd think the air quality would be better.
And unfortunately, it's not that simple.
An NPR investigation finds that recent air pollution declines aren't as big as you might think. Turns out there are lots of other sources of air pollution.
I think that this really brings into clear view, in a way that we've never seen before, the choices that we have to make as a society.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and War Eagle. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Timothy Dennis mastered our show tonight. Contributors this evening included Jacqueline Froelich, Zuzanna Sitek, Antoinette Grajeda, and Roby Brock. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Schultz. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. It's titled The First Hurrah. Tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30, news of our area and state newscast with Antoinette Grajeda. And at 6:30 and 8:30 tomorrow morning, the Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman. You can listen to past editions of Ozarks at Large, as well as individual stories and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. You know a place where they keep podcasts? Well, the Ozarks at Large podcast is there, and it's free. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. We will return tomorrow at noon for another edition of Ozarks at Large.